Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Documenting the horrors of war and human rights violations through film and photography have raised awareness and inspired people to act for decades. But today, the internet and social media has made it possible to instantly document human rights violations and transmit photos to a global audience within seconds. The UC Berkeley Human Rights Center is celebrating its 20th anniversary by showcasing the work of human rights photographers around the globe. The Envisioning Human Rights exhibit will showcase collections of photos by 10 world-renowned photographers whose work addresses a wide range of human rights violations, including troubling mass graves in Iraqi Kurdistan and sex trafficking in Eastern Europe. The exhibit features photos from Bosnia, Guatemala, Bolivia, Brazil, Angola, Uganda, Tanzania, Burma, Vietnam, Moldova, Iraq, and the United States. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the power of images to raise awareness about human rights violations. Eric Stover, faculty director of the Human Rights Center, says the featured photographs remind us that human rights photography is at its best when it shuns the sensational and sentimental and instead finds human dignity in the face of injustice. Eric Stover is faculty director of the Human Rights Center and adjunct professor of law and public health at UC Berkeley. He has worked on the front lines of human rights abuses and war crimes around the globe, and he joins me in studio. Hi, Eric. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Alexa Koenig, executive director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley. Alexa has led workshops on new technology and human rights and how the use of technology is changing how we document human rights abuses. And Alexa is also in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Jean Marie Simon. She's worked in Guatemala as a photojournalist between 1980 and 1988. Her work is published in the book Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny. And she joins us from Washington. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And I should say that you can check out these photos at the website envisioninghumanrights.com, and the exhibit runs from this Thursday through October at the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center. So, Alexa, I want to start off with you. At a time when we are completely saturated with photos, what are you hoping this exhibit accomplishes?
I hope it accomplishes a few things. One is to bring awareness to the incredible stories of the people behind the images, both the people who are documented in the pictures that are taken and also the people who are doing the documenting. One of the great aspects of this show, as Eric has mentioned, is this focus on the dignity of the individual, the incredible survival of these people who have withstood some of the worst human rights abuses we've known. That sense of perseverance is an important one. I think in a world where we are so saturated often with media images, it's important to focus on the positive, the possibility for survival, the possibility for making sense out of something that often comes across as quite senseless.
Mm. Eric, what would you add to that?
Well, I'd begin. It's our 20th birthday. Mm-hmm. It's our 20th anniversary for the center. So it's a little bit of looking back over time. What have we been engaged in at the center? Many of these photographers have worked with us or are associated in some way with UC Berkeley. I've worked in the field with many of these photographers. And I think what I learned from them, and I think they are conveying in their work, is the need to slow down in this rapidly changing world. And one, as you say, which is saturated with images, and to stop and look at these photographs and try and understand what's happening before and after the photographs being taken, meaning these are photographs that are conveying a story, a time. They've captured a moment in which these images should resonate over time, and we should think about what's being said. And I think if that can be conveyed to people who come to see the show and go online, that would satisfy me.
Mm-hmm. Jean Marie, your photos are included in the exhibit, and they focus on repression in Guatemala. You first traveled there in 1980, and you published the book Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny. What role do you see yourself playing in the year 2014 as someone who documents human rights violations at a time when we are so saturated with so much information and so many images.
It's interesting that you asked that because a few months ago on the Lawfare blog, I published a review of a book by Bob Nicholsberg, Afghanistan, A Distant War, and it posed this question of, you know, what is the role of a photographer when we're saturated with images by other photographers and amateur photographers? And with respect to my work in Guatemala over that decade, paradoxically, the images that Berkeley's Human Rights Center chose of my work are actually quite unwarlike, I guess you'd say, for lack of a better phrase. These are very quiet images. Mm. And I'm happy they chose them because in the end, I think images like this and you know, these other wonderful photographers in this show have in this exhibit have all done work in very depressing places, but most of our images in this show are actually quite the opposite of what one would expect. And I think in the end, these are very powerful counterpoint. They really, in some ways, underscore just the amount of suffering, because paradoxically, when you see images of not of you know, bodies lined up or of pitched battles, but instead people going about their lives despite these awful circumstances, it does sort of underscore the value of human dignity and just a desire to survive despite these awful moments.
It's interesting you say that, because when I read your bio and I read that you document repression in Guatemala, I was expecting to see something, you know, that does show that, that's something that's more violent. But for example, you have a photo of soldiers overseeing a traditional Mayan procession where the Guatemalan army massacred thousands of campesinos in the 1980s, but it's a very quiet photo. And then you've got another gorgeous photo of a Mayan community at the height of the Guatemalan government's Scorched Earth campaign in the early 1980s. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, what you said that you were glad that they chose these specific photos.
Yeah, for about a second I was surprised that the Human Rights Center chose these photos, but then I realized that a lot of the photos, these four photos, I guess three of the four were made when I first went to Guatemala, and most other people were leaving, and many of my contacts had fled the country or had disappeared. And so I filled my time initially taking pictures of daily life, and I was very unhappy about that. But now, 30 years later, I'm kind of relieved I did it. I'm relieved that there's this body of work, because, again, sort of counterintuitively, they're a body of work that actually exists in few other places. In Guatemala, for example, in the 80s, although photographers, this is not like the Middle East. There was no Al-Qaeda. There were not cafe bombings or beheadings of journalists. There were no pitched battles in Guatemala. Journalists could come and go. But the problem was they really weren't being paid to stay in a place like Guatemala. Most of the action was in El Salvador, in Nicaragua throughout 78, 79, 80. And so people really, it was a luxury for me to be able to stay in Guatemala over that decade. In addition, Guatemalans weren't taking pictures of this. Wealthy Guatemalans, if they were going to go on a trip, they weren't going to go to Chichicastenango, they weren't going to go to Nabox, they were going to go to Miami or Houston. And then most Guatemalans were just too poor to afford a camera. Taking a single family photo in front of one of those surreal photo stands with volcanoes popping out and stuff was a huge luxury. And so to some extent, these photos of daily life are in some ways, they are more rare than the photos of civil war, of army occupation, of people in morgues. And the funny part is that I thought Guatemalans would be completely uninterested in these photos. I thought that this new generation that wants to kind of recreate historical memory of Guatemala's armed conflict would go for the woman without her hands in a morgue or dead guerrillas in an army garrison. But instead, these 20-something Guatemalans are popping up on my Facebook page saying, "That's my uncle in the photo. That's my mom's house."
Wow.
So it's quite gratifying in that sense.
Wow. That is Jean Marie Simon. Her widely acclaimed book, Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny, tells the story of government-sponsored repression in Guatemala through photojournalism. And her photos will be featured at the Envisioning Human Rights exhibit. It's part of UC Berkeley Human Rights Center's 20th anniversary. It's kicking off this Thursday, and it'll go through October. And Eric, talk a little bit about the process involved in deciding which photographers to choose. I'm sure it was incredibly difficult. And then which photographs to choose.
Well, let's start with the photographers. They were actually rather easy to choose, although there are many of them. All of them, I think, at least for me, and I have worked with many of them, was the sense that these were photographers who were committed not to just parachuting in and leaving. They would go, as Jean Marie has, for years. And let me add to that, to give another example, what Jean Marie did in Guatemala, which is so important, is these photographs remind us of what could have, what was destroyed or was attempted to be destroyed. And it's reminding us of the culture. So then we see photographs of dead bodies and things like that. We don't necessarily understand the culture, the depth that's there, that's being destroyed. So that's it's also an act of preservation. And then the fact to see that there are soldiers surrounding this ceremony with people in traditional dress. Well, what's going on there? It evokes something without shoving it in your face. And so I think that what's important here in the show is that we again, as I said earlier, that we stop and we think about what's going on. That when we look at photographs, too, the minute we engage with them, and we need to think of what's our role afterwards. How do we look at this? Now, not all of us can go out and change things, but we certainly in our day-to-day lives can be thinking about the importance of what's trying to be captured in these photographs. One other photographer I might mention quickly is Thomas Morley. Thomas Morley grew up as a farmer in Devon. He was a farmer, and he loved photography, and he eventually left, and he covered the Chechnya War. He was beaten up badly there, and it took a year for him to recover. Grabbed his camera, went to northern Uganda. I met him in northern Uganda in 2005. We went out, and I have to tell you, northern Uganda from 1985 until recently was the forgotten humanitarian crisis of the world. There were camps where people, because of the Lord's Resistance Army, it's a rebel group, and government fighting, were crammed into these large camps. One was 62,000 people, most squalid camps I've ever seen in my 30 years or so working in human rights. And Tom and I went out to one camp, and Tom decided that he wanted to take portraits of people in the camp. I was a little nervous about this because I was on a mission with Human Rights Watch. I was interviewing people. But when the word got out, people gathered at the camp, and particularly women. They put on their best dresses. They put on some jewelry. Tom set up a chair under a tree, and he took photographs of these women. And it was so interesting to watch because they sat up straight. They adjusted their blouse and their jewelry. And it was as if they're looking into the camera and saying, I'm here. I survived. I'm not broken.
Wow.
And that is a powerful message to send.
I'm looking at one of Tom's photos right now of Akello Tariki Kalulu, 50 years old, married with 6 children. In 2002, the Lord's Resistance Army came to her village, burned down her family home, and stole her goods. The LRA then murdered 2 of her boys and abducted 3 of the others, 1 girl and 2 boys.
And she's living, and she's living in a camp on her own,
wow,
with nothing, and yet she wants the world to know. And this is the interesting thing: they wanted those photographs shown to show that we survived.
He also took a photo of her hands.
Yes.
His statement really stood out for me on your website. Thomas Morley says, quote, "The gap between those that have and those that don't grows ever larger. Discrimination, intolerance, bigotry, and abuse in much of society grows within poor communities and extreme situations such as conflict. And so to record these stories and to give the less fortunate a voice, I hope can lead to better understanding and tolerance of people who would otherwise go unnoticed and unloved."
Alexa, can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, I think that line, the people who would otherwise go unnoticed, especially that line.
You know, I think one of the most powerful things about images of human rights survivors is the sense of acknowledgement that you can give them for having lived, for having endured. In interviews that we've done with former Guantanamo detainees, Eric worked on a project for that for quite some time, and in other interviews of survivors, many times what they want is not necessarily money or their houses back. Sometimes they do need that very much. But the sense of acknowledgement for what they've endured, their loved ones have endured, it's a very powerful life-giving force that can be given in that social recognition. So many times what you need to prove a war crime is documentary evidence, so some kind of sense of what has occurred. That's the legal contribution that a photograph can make. But there's the social side to it as well, and I think that's really what's celebrated in this exhibit.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about the intersection of human rights abuses, international law, and then documenting what's happening. How are these photos used to bring justice? You've been doing this work for a long time, Eric. Can you give us a few examples?
Well, at the exhibit, when you come in, one of the first photographs you'll see is one by Susan Mysalis. And Susan is a photographer back 60s and 70s. She actually was the, if I'm correct, was the first photographer to use color film in documenting a war. And that was the Civil War in Nicaragua, a very famous book that she did. The story with Susan is I was asked just after the first Gulf War to take a forensic team into Iraqi Kurdistan. Now, the Saddam Hussein had just had the Anfal campaign, in which Iraqi troops destroyed some 4,000 villages, made them into rubble. And we knew there were mass graves all over that region. And so I went in with a forensic team, and Susan joined me. And as we went around documenting, exhuming these graves, and families would gather, Susan was taking the photographs. And the one photograph in this exhibit is of a woman standing over an open grave that that we've exposed in the village of Karimi. And what you're seeing there is the woman confronting the grave, but there's also a backstory to it. And that is, at that site, the villagers also wanted us to go up to craters that had been left by bombs that were dropped. These were chemical weapons. Soil samples were taken. They were sent off to a lab in London, and they were confirmed to be chemical weapons.
Wow.
The evidence that the forensic team gathered from these graves, and that very grave you see in the photograph, was used in the trial of Saddam Hussein. So it's accomplishing both the investigation and also portraying the dignity of the family that's there observing the site.
That is Eric Stover, Faculty Director of the Human Rights Center and Adjunct Professor of Law and Public Health at UC Berkeley. He has worked on the front lines of human rights abuses and war crimes around the globe. Alexa Koenig is Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley. She's led workshops on new technology and human rights and how the use of technology is changing how we document human rights abuses. And Jean Marie Simon has worked in Guatemala as a photojournalist. Her work is published in the book Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny. And today we are talking about the power of images. The UC Berkeley Human Rights Center is celebrating its 20th anniversary by showcasing the work of human rights photographers around the globe. The Envisioning Human Rights exhibit kicks off this Thursday, and you can see these photos through October. You can see them now. I'm sure they're much more powerful in person, right? At envisioninghumanrights.com. And we'd love to hear from you. What makes you really slow down and look at a photo and take it all in at a time when we are completely bombarded by images? What makes an effective photo? If you work in this field, we'd love to hear from you. And when we're talking about human rights abuses, Jean Marie said something earlier. She was really glad that the exhibit decided to showcase some of the more peaceful photos as opposed to the ones that would elicit maybe a cringe because it's a violent photo. So what are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Jean Marie, earlier we were talking about the importance of you know, not being a sort of a fly-in reporter, and we have so many of those now because budgets have been cut. Can you talk about the importance of really getting to know the community and staying in a place, well, in your case, for 8 years? But talk about how you made that decision, and what do we lose when we don't have enough people documenting not just abuses, but so many events around the globe for long periods of time?
Well, I guess first I'd say that people who go in and take pictures quickly, they make some of the most powerful images out there, and we need those images. I think one of the reasons I decided to stay in Guatemala was, first, as I mentioned earlier, it was not a place where one could be commercially successful, despite what was going on. There were Time and Newsweek had bureaus in El Salvador, but Guatemala was considered a real outpost except for interest in elections and coups. I guess my sense of coverage is, and I tried to do this both in the original Norton publication of Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny, and then in two Spanish editions that we did in Guatemala in 2010, 2012, which we're reissuing on Kindle and iTunes later this year as a bilingual edition, is this interplay between text and photos. The decisive moment to me is always enhanced, I guess, by text. And this to me is sort of underscored, and when I look at other people's photo books, the more successful ones, going back to what Eric said, I think, about a backstory behind images, this literal subtext that accompanies images is to me an integral part of telling a story. There's a shock value to shocking images. It produces an immediate reaction. But to me, an image without substantial text is incomplete. For example, when I reviewed Bob Nicholsberg's book on Lawfare, I was talking about another book as well, a very good book by Susie Linfield called The Cruel Radiance, and she talks about the importance of photojournalism. Linfield is clearly an expert in her field. There was, however, one thing I took exception to. She said that Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, she could not imagine them functioning without in a pre-photographic age. And of course, they functioned very well in a pre-photographic age. There was no digital photography in the 1980s. It's hard to imagine now, when everybody has a little $100 Canon with 12 megapixels embedded. But again, going back to what Eric said about this backstory, I found this really enticing, especially when I heard Susan Mizellis talk about some of her photos in the Nicaragua book. And when she told these back stories about these photos, it made them stand out for me even so much more. And we all know that Nicaragua book is a seminal book in photojournalism. As Eric said, it was the first or one of the first color photography books of war. But when I heard Susan give an interview talking about these images, I think one of a woman in red wheeling her dead husband in a wheelbarrow, and how Susan felt sort of there was something, if I'm not mistaken, predatory about making that image. The image just popped out for me.
And Jean Marie, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today sure. We are talking about the Envisioning Human Rights photo exhibit at the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center. What happens when we better understand people who would otherwise go unnoticed? We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. Or you can send your question or comment to the email box, which is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. At noon today, backstory. And then at 1, alternative radio. Here on KALW San Francisco.
Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Shakti Butler, founder of World Trust, an organization that works to eliminate racial injustice. Her documentary, Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity, explores racism as a system with multiple layers functioning simultaneously. So how should we talk about racism? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the power of images. What happens when we better understand people who would otherwise go unnoticed? We're specifically talking about the Envisioning Human Rights exhibit at the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center. It opens on Thursday. It'll run through October. And you can check out the website, envisioninghumanrights.com. It's also at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Eric Stover, faculty director of the Human Rights Center and adjunct professor of law and public health at UC Berkeley. He has worked on the front lines of human rights abuses and war crimes around the globe. He's recently been in Kenya, Burma, and Guatemala. Alexa Koenig is executive director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley. She focuses on how the use of technology is changing how we document human rights abuses. And Jean Marie Simon has worked in Guatemala as a photojournalist. She published the book Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny, and her photos are in the Envisioning Human Rights exhibit. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the power of using images to raise awareness and inspire people to act? If there's an image that stands out for you, we'd love to hear from you. And when you go to an exhibit, what gets you to slow down and really take it all in at a time when we're bombarded by images? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from John in Miami. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was listening, and one of the things that really struck me was back in 2010, there was a group of women in Cuba, ladies in white, that for years had been marching, and in that year, there were a lot of very strong images that emerged of violence during demonstrations by government officials against them. And what I saw afterwards was a dynamic internationally, groups like Amnesty International and others that were condemning the violence, but also internally in Cuba, people like Carlos Varela, a very well-known pop artist in Cuba, actually came out and denounced the acts of repudiation. And within a space of about 3 to 4 months, we saw a lot of these, the family members of these ladies, which was the reason that they were out marching, they'd been arrested in March of 2003, were released, many of them exiled to Spain, but about a dozen were freed back into Cuba. And I think that's a very dramatic example of the power of images, in this case of these ladies, yeah, to actually affect the dynamics of what was taking place inside the country.
Oh, well, thanks so much. That's a great story. Thank you for calling in. Jean Marie, it's kind of related to the story that you shared earlier. Can you talk a little bit, before we let you go, about how you distributed copies of your book to young people so they remember what happened to their country?
Sure. I thought my Guatemala book ended in 88 when I went off to law school, but I got involved in Guatemala again in 2008, mostly by accident, thanks to Frank Goldman, a friend and wonderful writer, who drew me back in. And thanks to a Kickstarter campaign and to a couple grants, we were able to republish the English version, the Norton version, in Guatemala. Print Studio, fabulous publisher in Guatemala, did it. It sold out in about 6 months. It was a $50 coffee table book in Spanish. We used those funds and, again, the Kickstarter campaign to publish what we called a student version, a much cheaper $10. We priced it at $10 to make it affordable to Guatemala's emerging class. But we also committed ourselves to donating a third of the 4,000 print run to NGOs in Guatemala, public schools, communities in resistance, Mayan groups, and in fact, happily, we've exceeded that. We've now donated over 2,000 of the 4,000 print run within Guatemala, sometimes to people who will come down to a community and take 40, 50 copies of the book back up a dirt road to a community 6 hours off the beaten track.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for... Oh, did you want to jump in, Eric, before we let Jean Marie go?
Yeah, I would comment. That's another quality that these photographers bring, mm-hmm, is that they give back to the community. And what Jean Marie did was someone who went back and took the photographs, informed the world, but also gave it back to the community. And this is extremely important. One photographer that I've worked with is Gilles Perez, and we documented the exhumations throughout Bosnia. And we had these photographs, quite shocking. We were worried about publishing them, but we went to see the families and the mothers of Srebrenica, the women of Srebrenica. And in a meeting, we showed the photographs, and there were tears, and it was, you know, it was terrible to see. But the women in the end said, yes, take those photographs, and please show the world. We published a book and brought the book back so that the women could sell them to people who came through to visit their offices. And this is the important thing. And this is why slowing down, looking, engaging with the photographs, and thinking about what you can do.
Jean Marie, what are you working on now?
We're actually working on a Kindle and iTunes version of this, again with Print Studio in Guatemala. We found that it makes it cheaper to print in Guatemala. The quality is exactly the same or better as what we'd get in Tokyo or the U.S. And we are publishing a Kindle version. It will be completely bilingual. You look at it, your iPad horizontally, it'll come out in English, vertically in Spanish. We're embedding 280 photos. A third of them are new. They've never been published before. I found them by accident. They were lost for 20 years and then found. All the text from the English and Spanish versions will be embedded. We'll have Google Maps. We'll have clips from video clips from documentaries that I made back in the 80s. And it will be sort of a very slim but full compendium of that armed conflict. And our real goal is to make it available in the United States, outside the United States, to the Guatemalan diaspora in the United States, and now in Guatemala too, because even in the last 5 years, we found that that the tablets actually have become more accessible to a lot more people in Guatemala.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That is Jean Marie Simon. Her widely acclaimed book, Guatemala, Eternal Spring, Eternal Tyranny, tells the story of government-sponsored repression in Guatemala through photojournalism. And her photos will be on display at the Envisioning Human Rights exhibit. It's part of the 20th anniversary at the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center. It kicks off on Thursday and runs through October. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we're joined today by Eric Stover, Faculty Director of the Human Rights Center and Adjunct Professor of Law and Public Health at UC Berkeley. He's worked on the front lines of human rights abuses and war crimes around the globe. Alexa Koenig is Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley, and she focuses on how the use of technology is changing how we document human rights abuses. It was interesting to hear Jean Marie talk about Kindles and how more people now have access to Kindles. So what's really struck you about how social media and technology has changed the way we not only interact with these kinds of photos, but how we have such access to them immediately?
You know, I think that's one of the great things about bringing in a photography show, because it does force us, just through the medium that we're using, to slow down and engage very one-on-one with each image that we see. Technology is a real boon in many ways for the human rights community, in that it does help us to gather evidence of war crimes as they're happening. It's amazing the number of perpetrators who want to brag about what they've accomplished, as sad as that may be, to post pictures of their exploits and the people that they've harmed. That makes it easier in some ways for people who are documenting these abuses to gather evidence of the crimes, sometimes in real time as they're occurring, and also to eventually create a collection of images that can be used even if trials or prosecutions come 10, 20, 30 years from now. The evidence will hopefully be there and be preserved. There's, though, a rapidity with how things happen. So, for example, so many people will brag about what they've done on Facebook or will post images that are really gruesome images there. But then when they realize that investigators are trying to track them down, we'll take them down quite quickly. So one of the things that you see happening in the activist world is people creating shadow Facebook, shadow Twitters, trying to capture that evidence or that information as it's posted in real time and document minute for prosecutions and accountability in the future.
What about the citizens' reaction to abuses and just human rights violations around the globe? Because we have access to so much information of war and horror, frankly. Mm-hmm. We were talking before the show that because of social media here in the West Coast, when we go to bed, people in Gaza are just waking up. And it's been really interesting and unsettling and really horrible, frankly, to follow the Facebook and Twitter feeds of a lot of the journalists we've had on who are in Gaza. So when I go to bed, I check their feeds and they're just waking up, giving you a first impression of what it's been like. And so what are your thoughts on that, Eric, that we have now access to this in real time? How does it change our perception of what's happening?
Well, maybe I could put it again in a story or I think let's go to Abu Ghraib. So Abu Ghraib was the prison in outside of Baghdad when American forces took it over. It was at a time when American forces, allied forces, were trying to stop the resistance. And so they set up, the CIA set up a torture center there, and so did other military units. And in came these young men and women to guard the prison. And their role was to soften up the detainees who were brought in for interrogation. And in so doing that, these young soldiers were under a constant attack. I mean, the conditions in the prison were terrible. And they started abusing the prisoners. And we know the iconic photographs that came out. Mm. And a young man, one of the guards there, Joe Darby, collected these photographs, and then eventually they went public. And what's important there is we've documented this. We see it. As citizens, we see it. But it's not telling us the whole story, because what's behind the story is not there are no photographs from inside the CIA detention center. There are no it doesn't tell you anything about what happened in the prison, what led to this, and that there were higher-ups who let this happen. And then, in many ways, covered it up. Hmm. And it wasn't for General Antonio Taguba coming in his investigation. So why I'm saying this is, as the citizens, when we see these photographs, we're horrified. But it calls on us to say to our own government, let's talk about this. What happened here? Why did this take place? And this was done under my watch as a citizen, mm. and I want to know. So I would hope the photographs, you can't get on a plane and go to, you can't go to Iraq or you can't go to Guatemala, but you can be active and you can ask those questions, because that's what these photographs are calling for.
I think there's also, though, a real danger today where things are happening so quickly and we become mobilized so fast that many people, when they're looking at these images on Facebook or through other social media platforms, they're only getting the feeds of the people to whom they're already subscribed. So there's the potential, perhaps more so than historically, for there to become two very powerful narratives around what's occurring that don't intersect. And when you had traditional journalism, I think there was more opportunity in the marketplace to really push back on that one image that everyone saw. Now there may be two complete sets, different sets of images that are circulating and mobilizing people in very different directions.
Hmm. That is Alexa Koenig, Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley. Eric Stover is Faculty Director of the Human Rights Center. And the Envisioning Human Rights exhibit will open on Thursday, and it goes through October. And now I would like to welcome Mimi Chakarova to the show. For the past decade, photographer and filmmaker Mimi Chakarova has covered global issues examining conflict, corruption, and the sex trade. And I think we just lost Mimi. We will reconnect with her. In the meantime, we've got a few listeners on the line. Can we take a caller? Let's hear from... who's next? We've got Denise in San Francisco. Hi, Denise.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. My comment on this is, I think that it's very, very important for the public to see these images, the images that are true and real. I know that they're very harsh, but I think that the public needs to have awareness, and the visuality, of the photography is very, very powerful. I mean, I'm very aware of that. Even more so than when people read about things. You know, I mean, you're it's just instantaneous when you do see a photograph. And so it creates awareness, empathy, and, you know, can empower the people. And I think that that's a really good thing. You know, we need to know exactly what's going on. And, you know, for us to take any type of action, to have empathy has to reach your heart. So that's what I had to say.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Alexa?
So one thing I would want to say in response to that is we were very careful, too, about where we put these photographs. Mm. So one of the audiences we were really hoping to reach was the UC Berkeley community and the Berkeley Law School in particular, with the idea that because images are so powerful at mobilizing people to take action, if you have such an amazing group of students like you do in Berkeley more broadly, you want them to be educated about some of the major issues of our times and to be thinking about how they can be using their world-class educations to hopefully further things along in a positive direction.
Well, Mimi Chakarova was a student at UC Berkeley, right?
That's right.
So we'll talk about her story. We just reconnected with Mimi. She's a photographer and filmmaker. Her film, The Price of Sex, is a feature-length documentary about young Eastern European women who've been drawn into a netherworld of sex trafficking and abuse. Hi, Mimi. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. You know, I saw your film at the Human Rights Film Fest at UCSF, and I'm so glad that you're joining us today because it's so incredibly powerful. You were a student at UC Berkeley. How did you decide to spend so much time? You even went undercover in a brothel in Turkey. How did you decide to dedicate so much of your life to this issue?
You know, not only was I a student at UC Berkeley, but I actually remember being 22 and taking one of Eric's classes at the Human Rights Center and being very much inspired by people like Jill Perez, by Eric Stover, Susan Micellas, some of the photographers you're going to see at this exhibit, and feeling like these are people who have dedicated so much of their time and so much of their energy in places to expose certain truths that the public should be aware of. So I would say I looked up to them, and I very much wanted to follow in their footsteps. And in fact, I remember Susan Micellas saying, you know, why are you not going back to Eastern Europe and doing an investigation on sex trafficking and photographing, finding these women who have managed to escape and photographing them. So this whole project started when I was in my mid-20s. I'd already graduated. I was teaching at Berkeley at the School of Journalism. And the idea was to go back as often as I could and photograph, find these women, and then visually document the ordeal that they had been through, which took a very long time. So altogether, the film and the photography and the reporting took 7 years of my life and a lot of different trips in 9 different countries. And it's a personal story. It's very much about where I come from. I grew up in a small village in Bulgaria, close to the border, and after the collapse of communism, a lot of young women, just like myself, had gone abroad with their families or on their own, and had fallen, some of them had fallen into sex trafficking rings and were sold into slavery. So this was not exposed by the media until the mid-90s. And only years later did the general public find out of what happens to these women and the horrors that they go through. So it was very much, you know, this quest to not only, you know, show their faces, not only be able to interview them and show you where they come from and how they live and what happened to them, but do it in a very intimate way, which is why it took such a long time. Mm-hmm. And have you as the viewer feel really close and connected to them, and instead of judging them because of the stigma in Eastern Europe and throughout the world, actually, with women who go through this, for people to feel compassion and a deep level of understanding and empathy.
We spoke earlier with Jean Marie Simon, who's done work in Guatemala, about people that she met who wanted their stories told, women in Uganda who wanted their stories told. Can you give us a few personal stories, some examples that you have when you interviewed some of these women, and what did they tell you? What story did they want to tell you? You've got a photo of Vika and Olsi, a secret shelter for women in Moldova. You have another of a very close-up eye of a woman in Moldova. What were those conversations like?
Well, I will tell you two brief stories. The story about Vika is I met her when she was in her early 20s, and she had been trafficked to Dubai at the age of 19. And she had a horrific story of what had been done to her. She also got pregnant by one of her first clients in Dubai and was sold three times to different brothels during her pregnancy. They kept her pregnant, and she eventually, you know, was deported and never was able to see her child. She gave birth, and the child remained in Dubai. And Dika and I became very close, and she allowed me to take photographs of her for 4 years. And at the end of those 4 years, I really wanted to interview her. I wanted people to see her on camera because she has such a powerful, strong presence. And I remember at the end of those 4 years going back to Moldova and meeting with her in her hometown and saying, Vika, you know, she said, what is all of this stuff in your bag? I said, it's actually not just a photo camera, it's a video camera and a tripod and mics and so on. And she said, you have to be crazy. I'm not going to go on camera. I'm so ashamed of what happened. I don't want the world to know this. And I sat there at this coffee shop where we met, and I said, what if it were to help other girls? What if you speaking on camera and telling your story to the world is going to prevent other girls from falling into the same trap that you fell into? And that's the reason that she agreed to go on camera, with the promise that it would be the last time she speaks to me about Dubai, and I kept that promise. The other photograph that you mentioned of Maya and the eye, she was trafficked to Russia at a very, very young age as well, and she managed to escape. And, you know, her story was extremely tragic, and she didn't feel comfortable revealing her identity, so I had to find creative ways to still photograph her and still show the pain that she felt without showing her full face. So, you know, every young woman who I met, and I've interviewed so many young women, every single young woman has her own story, and we cannot generalize. Every single story is unique to this person, and every single young woman has a different level of resilience. Some women die, some women lose their minds because of what's being done to them, and some women, like Vika, they're able to continue living their lives because of their strength and because of their composure and because of their resilience. So, you know, I think it's very important to, and I hope that through the film and through the photographs, but especially through the documentary film, that people can see the individual stories and not generalize that, not put them under the category of victim. That was very important for me, to see them as human beings and not as victims.
And that is photographer and filmmaker Mimi Chakarova. She has covered global issues examining conflict, corruption, and the sex trade. Her documentary, The Price of Sex, is a feature-length documentary about young Eastern European women who've been drawn into a netherworld of sex trafficking and abuse. And you can find information at priceofsex.org. You can also find it at yourcallradio.org. So, Eric, will you talk about the power of the photographs and then how that works to inspire people to possibly see this film? I mean, when I saw it at the Human Rights Festival, people were just shocked, angry, and saying, what can be done about this? Because different governments clearly have to get involved to tackle this massive, massive issue.
Well, and I think that's it, and that's what Mimi is trying to say here, is that she went back for so many years to document and tell the story. If you parachute in and leave, you're going to show one part of that story, and it's important that it get exposed. And let me, you know, it's worthwhile putting this in a historical perspective. In the United States, the first exposure we had to really war crimes that were taking place and death in war was done by a New York photographer by the name of Matthew Brady. And during the Civil War, Northern troops who went down, often the families waiting wanted to have photographs sent back of their young men who went to fight. And Matthew Brady and his team would go down and take these photographs. Well, they started taking photographs of war crimes and photographs of dead bodies. And these are gradually being published in the New York Times and elsewhere. People were horrified to see it. There were editorials about, you know, we can't look at this. But he brought it home. And so I think there's a tribute there to the courage to come out and do that. I also want to mention something that, that brings this show together, and that is something I learned in the field years ago working with photographers. Unlike scribblers, unlike journalists who are out there sending stories, and no offense to journalists, I'm one, but photographers are a very different breed. Back in the time when there was rolls of film, if you were out in the field somewhere and you ran out of film, you knew you could call your mate back somewhere who was coming in to bring you the film. There was a camaraderie there of working together. And I think this sort of underscores the show. You asked me earlier about how the photographs were chosen, and our curator, Pamela Blattner, is an artist. Full disclosure, she's also my wife. She's also worked in many of these countries with me. The same with the Human Rights Center staff. We all work together. This we know these photographers. And so the time she took with an artist's eye to pull it together is important.
Eric Stover is faculty director of the Human Rights Center and adjunct professor of law and public health at UC Berkeley. Alexa Koenig is executive director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley. And Mimi Chakarova is a photographer and filmmaker. Be sure to check out The Price of Sex, her documentary about sex trafficking of Eastern European women, priceofsex.org. And again, the Envisioning Human Rights exhibit kicks off this Thursday and runs through October. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How should we talk about racism? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Shakti Butler, founder of World Trust, an organization that works to eliminate racial injustice through transformational education. Her documentary, Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity, explores racism as a system with multiple layers functioning simultaneously. So what are different forms of racism, and how should they be confronted? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.